All right, so this is bio 231, and it's October 22nd. Just got back from the disaster drill. It wasn't too much of a disaster, which is a good thing. And we're just preparing for the test on Monday. We're talking about muscles. How are we going to name or answer questions on the test related to insertion and origin? And one of the powerful techniques is understanding something about muscles is if you look at the name of a muscle, sometimes what information can you garner from the name of a muscle? You can get its action because sometimes we name muscles by their action, like for instance, flexor digitorum longus. That's a flexor, so that's really easy. All right, and then if you know what body compartment it's in, okay, you're going to say what? If it's a flexor digitorum, it's going to be anterior forearm. I could ask you, well, what's a antagonistic muscle to the flexor digitorum? Okay, extensor digitorum. Or I could ask you what body compartment it's in. Other powerful ways of knowing information that you don't just have to memorize is by knowing nomenclature. We also name muscles by their origin and insertion. So can anybody give me an example of a muscle that we name by its specific origin and insertion? And how do you know which is which? Sternocleidomastoid is one we covered in lecture quite a bit. All right, so the origin is always the first part of the name. The insertion is always the second part of the name. So I will probably test you on nomenclature. I'll probably pick a muscle that you have never heard of before, and you've got to tell me what the origin or insertion is. So you have to demonstrate that you appreciate nomenclature. So when you see a muscle that you've never heard of, okay, then you're going to know that you have to use your knowledge of nomenclature to pick the origin and insertion. And if you know the origin and insertion, you know what body compartment it's in, and you also know what? The action that it produces, right? So just by knowing nomenclature, you can ascertain a lot about a muscle. All right, so I think that's all I want to say about the test coming up. And it's going to have between 80 and 100 questions, just like the last test. And I don't think anybody was rushed for time during the last test, so I like to have more questions rather than fewer as long as you don't run out of time during the test. So everybody had plenty of time. So look over your answers. Make sure you fill in every answer on your Scantron, right? Don't leave anything blank. That still happens. So what technique do I use to make sure that I don't skip a line? Yeah, I flip it around somehow, some way that I've never seen the Scantron before and my eye can pick it up. But if I just look at it the way I fill it in, for some reason my mind must memorize the pattern or something and I don't see a mistake. But if I do something funny to the Scantron, then I can see that I've left a line blank. All right, so be careful about that. Okay, so central nervous system. I see where we're going to start. Spinal cord. Okay, that's where we left off last time. So don't forget, the spinal cord is part of the central nervous system along with the brain. And the spinal cord starts at the foramen magnum, and it extends down to the second lumbar vertebrae, and there it ends. It doesn't extend all the way down to the bottom of the vertebral column. Because as during development, as we grow, our musculoskeletal system grows a lot faster than our nervous system can. And so the spinal cord can't possibly grow to the same length as the vertebral column. All right, the gray matter in the spinal cord is located deep. That's different than the brain, because where is the gray matter in the brain? It's really on the surface. We call that cortical gray matter, except for various nuclei that are deep inside the brain, like the basal nuclei, for instance. But gray matter is deep. And the periphery and the periphery, or the superficial parts of the spinal cord, that's white matter. And what can somebody tell me about white matter or gray matter? What parts of a neuron are they? Gray matter is nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and those parts of a neuron are never myelinated, so they just kind of have a gray color. But axons, on the other hand, if they are myelinated, they look white. So white matter is composed of myelinated axons that are going someplace. And in most cases in the spinal cord, if it's a white matter, if it's a tract, it's either ascending or descending. So if it's ascending, what kind of tract is that going to be in terms of function? What kind of tract is ascending to the brain, as opposed to what kind of tract is descending, carrying information away from the brain. So one is going to be efferent and the other is going to be afferent, or one is going to be motor and the other is going to be sensory. Make sure you know that differentiation. Okay, so there are two paths, either in or out of the spinal cord, and we call these roots on one side. But these are bilateral. You have four roots at one level of the spinal cord. You've got two dorsal roots and two ventral. You have a right and left dorsal root and a right and left ventral root. And roots are always one or the other. They're either going to be 100% motor or 100% sensory. They're never a combination of the two kinds of functions. And the word we use to talk about the combination is, anybody know when we talk about a nerve, if it has both functions, both motor and sensory function, what do we call that kind of pathway? That's called mixed. All right, so roots are never mixed. They're either one or the other. Okay, so let me see if I can find a picture of some of this stuff right here. Oh, probably going the wrong way. I probably was going the right way. Okay, close your eyes. I'm going to go really fast through some of this stuff right here. All right, so here's some spinal cord information for us. All right, I guess I'll start right here. Okay. Ah, I know what I can do. I can zoom in. All right, so here's a foramen magnum in the occipital bone that defines the superior margin of the spinal cord, and it goes down all the way to L2, and you can see the very tip of the spinal cord. We call that the conus medullaris. It's just a tapered end of the spinal cord. But issuing from this tapered end are nerves, of course, that are going to leave through the lower lumbar region and sacral region right here. So in that intervertebral canal, you do have nerves even though there's not a spinal cord. And that accumulation of spinal nerves inside the vertebral column right here is what we call the cauda equina. So how can you remember that? What does cauda mean? It means tail. Right, and equina refers to what's an equestrian that has somebody that owns horses or likes horses or whatever. So when you look at this right here, we call that just a horse's tail, the cauda equina. All right, but nonetheless, can you see the conus medullaris and the end of the spinal cord right there? All right, something else that we see, there is a ligament that goes from the cauda of the conus medullaris down to the sacrum, right, that applies a little bit of pressure to the spinal cord so that it doesn't shrink back up to the brain, right, and so that just stabilizes the spinal cord. Every once in a while during development, the conus medullaris adheres to the sacrum in some individuals. Right, and then as they start to grow, that damages the spinal cord and produces all kinds of nervous system deficits, both motor deficits and sensory deficits in the individual. And then you have to do surgery to release that adhesion so that the spinal cord can retract back up to the brain. And that condition is called a tethered cord. All right, so that's just something else probably that you should be aware of. You notice that there are some enlargements in the spinal cord. Here's the cervical enlargement. Here's the lumbar enlargement right here. And why do you think the spinal cord has these enlargements in these two locations? What does this correspond to in your body? These correspond to your upper appendages here and your lower appendages. And so you'd need additional nerves and additional reflexes to operate and protect those appendages, so there are more nervous tissues in these two regions right here, so the spinal cord is actually thicker. Okay. If we look at a cross-section of the spinal cord, Here we can see the gray matter of the spinal cord, and we can see the white matter in the superficial region. So the gray matter, again, is nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And we talk about the different areas of the gray matter. So for instance, this is posterior, right, or dorsal. So this, we call this a horn, all right, or this area of the gray matter is what we call the dorsal horn. This is the lateral horn, and this is the ventral horn. These contain nerve cell bodies. So for instance, in the dorsal horn, we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites of interneurons or association neurons. In the lateral horns, we have nerve cell bodies for the sympathetic nervous system, which is a part of the autonomic nervous system. And in the ventral horn right here, we have nerve cell bodies for motor neurons. All right, so we said motor neurons and association neurons and sympathetic neurons. There's another kind of neuron, which is a sensory neuron. We don't see nerve cell bodies of sensory neurons in the central nervous system, but we do see it on this picture right here. Where do we see a group of nerve cell bodies of a sensory neuron? As a matter of fact, what kind of neuron is a sensory neuron? Is a unipolar neuron. It's a unipolar neuron, right? And where we would see the cell body of a unipolar neuron is over here in the dorsal root ganglion. So remember, an accumulation of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system is what we call a ganglion. So this is not inside the central nervous system. This is in the peripheral. So this is the dorsal root ganglion. And on this slide, we can see the two roots. Here's a root, and here's a root. So this is the dorsal root, and this is the ventral root. These are the only two ways, either entering or leaving the spinal cord. The dorsal root is always going to be sensory, so sensory information comes in via that unipolar neuron, synapsing on an association neuron right here. And then the motor neuron, here's the cell body of a motor neuron, and that's going to leave the ventral root. And then the roots come together to form a spinal nerve. So how would you talk about a spinal nerve in terms of its function? Is it motor? Is it sensory? Or is it that third kind of function that we were talking about? It's what we call mixed, right? Because it contains both efferent and afferent signals. Okay. So what else do we see on this particular diagram? Well, in the gray matter, we see a communication between the right and left sides of the gray matter in the spinal cord, and we call this the commissure, central commissure, the gray commissure between the horns of the gray matter between the right and left side of the brain. And what do we call ways for information to go from one side of the central nervous system to the other? What kind of pathway is that? Is that like a contain projection fiber or association fibers, or the last one was commissural fibers going from one side to the brain to the other. All right, so that contains commissural fibers going from one side of the body to the other. Okay, so on this diagram, we can see the gray matter very nicely. We can see the gray commissure, and inside the right in the middle of the spinal cord, we see the central canal. The central canal contains cerebral spinal fluid. And the white matter right here also has names. Sometimes, so these are going to contain tracts that are either ascending or descending. And sometimes we would call this a column because there are tracts either ascending or descending. So this right here would be for instance, the anterior column, here would be the posterior column, and over here would be the lateral column. Another name for column is funiculus. So funiculus and column can be used interchangeably. All right, so generally speaking, in this class, you should probably know in what part of the spinal cord do you primarily have sensory columns as opposed to motor columns. And the architecture of the spinal cord roughly is going to follow the same kind of architecture that your brain has. So in your brain, what part of the brain is motor, responsible for motor activity? the frontal lobe, which is what? Anterior, right, or ventral. So in the anterior part, or ventral part of the spinal cord, right, where you should find motor tracts. That's not always the case, but that's usually a pretty good first assumption. And in the posterior part of the spinal cord, these are reserved for, if it's not motor, what's the other kind of tract? It's going to be sensory, because the posterior part of your brain is reserved for sensory function. Okay, so that's generally a good idea to just be aware of. Okay, so for instance, sometimes we need to sample cerebral spinal fluid from an individual. And cerebral spinal fluid, we're going to talk about this in just a second, also surrounds your brain as in, and is also in certain cavities that are deep inside the brain. Cerebral spinal fluid then flows down the exterior of the spinal cord, and if somebody gets an infection of the central nervous system, all right, we need to get some cerebral spinal fluid out to diagnose if somebody indeed has an infection and what kind of infection it is so that it can be treated properly. So for instance, yeah, an infection of the central nervous system is what we call meningitis because it involves the meninges, which is what we're going to look at next. And would you guess that's a relatively benign or dangerous kind of disease to have? Very dangerous, because your brain is controlling all these functions in your body, right? All right, so sometimes we call that a lumbar tap or a spinal puncture to get the cerebral spinal fluid out. And where do you think would be a good idea to get cerebral spinal fluid? Inserting a brain for aspirating some fluid out from the brain, or from the cervical region or thoracic region, or this lumbar region right here?
Lumbar.
Okay. And in particular, high in the lumbar region or lower in the lumbar region? Okay. All right, so it's a little bit of a semantics right here. Well, for sure, you don't want to poke a needle into somebody's brain because you might damage some very important neurons. And any place where there's spinal cord, you don't want to place a needle either, because you could damage some very important neurons in the spinal cord as well. So where you would like to get some cerebral spinal fluid is below the level of the conus medullaris. And that conus medullaris is about at what, L2? So anywhere below L2. So yeah, if you said L3, I suppose you might want to say the upper lumbar region, okay? But really someplace lower in the vertebral column, because as you insert a needle, okay, as we see the insertion of this needle right here aspirating some of that fluid out, you can actually push some of those nerves that make up the cauda equina away and not lacerate them. But if it's a structure like the spinal cord and you jab a needle into it, all right, you're going to damage that part of the spinal cord. Okay, so that's where it's contained. All right, so here is an illustration of the spinal cord, and you can see the gray matter and the white matter. Here is the dorsal root, and what can you tell me about the dorsal root? It's always going to be sensory, and does that correspond with the kind of neuron that you see? Does that make sense to you, because you see a nice unipolar neuron right there, while we see nice motor neurons leaving the ventral root? So how are you going to remember which root is motor, which one is sensory? Because you can remember the architecture of the brain, and the motor is always in the front, all right? But another way that I do it, even if I haven't thought about neuroanatomy in 25 years, I could remember this little trick. And maybe I told you this before, but all right, since this is the dorsal root right here, there's a nice S in dorsal, there's a nice S in sensory, and the ventral root has a nice T, and there's a nice T in motor. All right, so that's maybe one way that I can just double check in my mind real quick when I don't have time to think about things, so I say it correctly. Okay, so don't forget, they're never mixed. All right, let's go back to my lecture. All right, so we're done talking about these structures, the pathways. Okay, some examples of tracts in the columns, the white columns of the spinal cord. And this is actually going to be easy to do. I'm only going to ask you to know a couple tracts, like the spinal thalamic tract and the cortical spinal tract. And let's see where these are located. All right, so here is a lateral cortical spinal tract. lateral spinal thalamic tract. Okay, and again, from nomenclature, we can tell whether these are motor tracts or sensory tracts. So for instance, when we say spinal thalamic tract, the first part of that word tells the origin, and the second part of the word tells us where that nerve is actually going. So this is going from the spinal cord to what part of the brain? The thalamus, right? So this is an ascending tract or a sensory tract, as opposed to the cortical spinal tract. All right, the cortical spinal tract originates in the cerebral cortex and it goes to the spinal cord, right? So that's a descending or an efferent tract. So that's what I would like for you to know about those two particular tracts. And let's just look at the spinal thalamic tract, the one that's figure B on the right-hand side. All right, and trace it up to the brain. And let's count how many neurons it takes to get to the cerebral cortex. All right, so the spinal thalamic tract is a pain pathway. It transmits pain information. So, for instance, the pain will be a stimulus. Like, for instance, if somebody steps on a tack or something, you have to have a pain receptor, which is a free nerve ending. And that nerve goes all the way from, for instance, the bottom of your foot, through your ankle, up your leg, through your thigh, right? And it finally meets up with the vertebral column, and it enters the vertebral column, and that's a sensory neuron, so that's going to be a nice unipolar neuron, and here is the cell body and the dorsal root ganglia, enters the dorsal root, synapses on an association neuron, right? So here you can see the cell body of an association neuron. It crosses over through the gray commissure to the opposite side of the spinal cord, and then arises, it goes all the way through the spinal cord. How do I get back up here? Okay, goes all the way through the spinal cord, through the brainstem, to the thalamus, where it synapses a second time, right? Because what's the job of the thalamus again? It acts as a relay center, a relay station, and the thalamus tells what part of the brain that should go to, that particular modality. So this is the second synapse. So how many neurons did it take to get from the bottom of your foot all the way to the brain? All right, so here is the first one. All right, that's the sensory neuron entering the central nervous system. All right, and then here is the second one that goes all the way to the thalamus, and then the third one goes to the cerebral cortex. Now, since that's a nice sensory information, what part of the cerebral cortex is that going to? What part of the cerebral cortex is that going to? What lobe of the brain first? It's going to go to the parietal lobe. And what gyrus in the parietal lobe? We call that the postcentral gyrus because that's your primary somatosensory cortex, right? The postcentral gyrus. So that's where it goes. And if you look on that diagram, the little homunculus diagram, all right, then I would guess this is right here is where your foot would be, right? So that maps to that surface area on your body. So sometimes we call this a first order neuron, sometimes we call this a second order neuron, sometimes we call this a third order neuron. So it takes three neurons to get from a sensory receptor up to the cerebral cortex. And don't forget about the function of the thalamus right here. It acts as a relay center. All right, so that's the sensory tract that I want you to be aware of. And the other one I wanted you to be aware of was what? The cortical spinal tract. Where do I have cortical spinal tract? Maybe I don't have cortical spinal tract. Ah, okay. Here's cortical spinal tract. Sometimes we call that a pyramidal tract, but this is going to start in the cerebral cortex. Now, what part of the cerebral cortex is this going to start with? What initiates motor activity? What part of the brain? The frontal lobe. What part of the frontal lobe in particular? The precentral gyrus, right? And so here is that first order neuron leaving the cerebral cortex, and it's going to go between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. You can see this is a nice white area of the brain right here, which contains tracts, myelinated axons. So this part of the brain right here is what we call the internal capsule. This is for projection fibers, right, that are leaving the brain. It goes into through the cerebral peduncle, right, into the brain stem, and then into the medulla. Here are the pyramids within the medulla. These are the bulges on the anterior side of the medulla. And then signals can even cross over at this point, right? We call that decussation. And if you look very closely at a real brain, you can see some, I drew this on the board last time, some cross hatches where you can actually see tracks crossing over between the different pyramids of the medulla. It descends, and then it synapses in the gray matter of the spinal cord where it's going to exit the central nervous system. So here is what we call a lower motor neuron. This is an upper motor neuron. And, of course, that's going to leave the ventral root and follow the spinal nerve to whatever effector organ it's innervating. So it only takes two nerves to leave the central nervous system. Okay, reflexes. Let's talk about reflexes a little bit. I think maybe we've talked about reflexes before here, but reflexes are predetermined, pre-wired circuits in your body that are designed to protect your body automatically and very rapidly without conscious thought. So a reflex is always going to start with something and it's always going to end with something else. And I don't have this on the slide, so you're going to have to fill this in. So what does a reflex always start with? A reflex always has to start with some kind of stimulus. All right, so and in order for you to appreciate that stimulus, you need a particular receptor for that stimulus. So if you want to perceive light, you need a receptor for light. Or what would you need? You need, in order to appreciate light, what do you need? You need photoreceptors, or you need eyes, for instance. Or if you want to perceive sound, you need receptors for hearing in your ears, right? And if you want to perceive pain, you need pain receptors in different parts of your body that are experiencing tissue damage. All right, so a reflex arc always starts with a stimulus. That stimulus is going to stimulate a receptor. And that receptor is then going to send a signal to a brain via a neuron. But what a special kind of neuron? What kind of neuron is going to take information to the brain? That's a afferent neuron, or you could say sensory. And then it's going to pass through the dorsal root ganglia into the dorsal root, into the spinal cord, where it will synapse with an association neuron. This association neuron will analyze that information and make a decision on what to do with that information. If indeed it is a signal that that association understands to be causing tissue damage, then it's going to send a signal out to the periphery to remove your body from that damaging stimulus. And so it's going to send a signal out through the ventral root, because that's the motor root, into that efferent neuron that's going to go to some effector organ. And in this particular case, an effector organ would be a muscle, causing that muscle to contract, withdrawing that part of the body from that harmful stimulus. So in this, you might want to put skeletal muscle right here. And when the skeletal muscle contracts, that's what we call the response. So a reflex arc always starts with the stimulus and it ends with the response. But you should know all these different components right here. So we can look at the three different neurons that make up a reflex arc. Let me see if I can find a reflex arc someplace. Where is there a reflex arc? And I don't have a reflex arc here. I don't have a reflex arc. Well, let's look at this. Here we see a sensory neuron. Okay. And over here we see a... do we see a motor neuron? No, I got to go to another slide. But we see an association neuron right here. The sensory neuron is part in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. All right. And this motor neuron right here is partly in the central nervous system and partly in the peripheral nervous system. Right? Then the last kind of neuron, which was on that previous slide, right? This association neuron right here, that's the only kind of neuron that is completely contained within the central nervous system. So sensory and motor neurons are part in the periphery, part in the central nervous system, but association neurons are wholly contained within the central nervous system. You never find any part of them in the peripheral nervous system. Yeah. That's the same thing as an interneuron, right? So interneuron and association neuron are always found in the central nervous system, while motor and sensory neurons are partly in both. All right, well, let's focus our attention now on the meninges, which is the membrane system that surrounds the central nervous system, both the brain and the spinal cord. And it has different divisions. The job of the meninges is to protect the brain from trauma and hold it in position, because the brain and spinal cord don't have any bones. There's really nothing supporting the brain, and it's very soft tissue, except for the meninges, which is surrounding the brain and spinal cord. And there are three main layers, from superficial to deep, of the meninges. We have the dura mater, we have the arachnoid, and the pia mater. The dura mater is the durable layer. It's the toughest layer. It's tougher than skin. It's just filled with all kinds of collagen that's very, very tough. It's even hard to cut with the scissors. You can cut it with a very sharp scalpel. When you do a brain dissection in lab, you'll see that it's actually really difficult to cut because it is so tough. It's tougher than an eggshell. All right, so that's the most superficial layer. Then the middle layer is the arachnoid. And then there's a layer that follows every little convolution on the brain, and we call that the pia mater. And the pia mater is the most delicate layer of the three. The arachnoid is somewhere in between the toughness of the dura mater and the pia mater. All right, so let's see if we can find where these guys are at. Okay. So here we go. Here is an exam figure, I'm sure. All right, let me really zoom into this region right here. All right, so here we see the scalp. And here we see a cranial bone, and of course layering the outside surface, cortical surface of every bone is what? The periosteum on the outside. And on the inside we have the endosteum, okay, but we're not really going to look at the medullary cavity of this bone. If we look at the deep surface of that cranial bone, it is also going to have a periosteum around it. All right, so here we see the deep periosteal layer of this cranial bone. All right, so the first layer of the meninges is the dura mater. So here we see the dura mater. Now, what color does that look like to you? It looks brown? Okay, brown and gray. If we put the inner periosteum together with this layer right here, that really composes the dura mater. So the dura mater has these two divisions to it. It has the periosteal layer as well as the meningeal layer right here. So these two layers put together form that very tough membrane that surrounds the brain. All right, the next layer is going to be the arachnoid. So this one here is arachnoid, and that sort of looks like a darker blue color to me. Here it is over here, a little purple. There's a little red in there. Okay, so here is the arachnoid. And you see that the dura and the arachnoid almost touch each other. There's really not much of a space between them. And the next layer is the pia mater. And you can see the pia, now that's a light blue, right? Okay. And the pia mater follows every little convolution. It follows every little indentation in the surface of the brain. And of course you can see nice cortical gray matter here. And there is connective tissue between the arachnoid and the pia mater that holds these two membranes together in position. All right, but this space right here is filled with a fluid, and that fluid is cerebrospinal fluid. So this space is, because it's underneath the arachnoid, we call this the subarachnoid space, filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebral spinal fluid is produced in the cavities of the brain. Actually, maybe now I'll talk about the cavities inside the brain. We call these ventricles, and then I'm going to come back to this one. Make sure you ask me to come back to this slide. Okay. All right. So the cavities inside the brain where are the cavities inside the brain located? I can see cavities in various locations, but the slide I'm looking for is, I suppose, that's not bad. That's close, but that's really the limbic system. That's neuronal tissue. Okay. Cavities inside the brain. Okay. Sorry, I don't know why I didn't see this before. Okay, so here you see the two hemispheres, the two cerebral hemispheres, and deep inside the cerebral hemispheres we have what used to be called the first and second ventricles. Now we just call these the lateral ventricles because they're off of midline, and they're filled with cerebral spinal fluid. This is what a lateral view looks like. Okay, so here is the inferior horn, here's the anterior horn, here's the posterior horn. I don't think you have to know that, but you should at least know that these are the lateral ventricles. And then there is a third ventricle, which is at the region, and it's right between the lobes of the thalamus. So this is the third ventricle right here. And the lateral ventricles do communicate with the third ventricle, so there are some passageways. So here's the passageway between the lateral ventricle and the third ventricle. We would call that the interventricular foramen. So cerebral spinal fluid does flow between the ventricles. And the fourth ventricle is down over here between the pons and the cerebellum. And there's a passageway between the third ventricle and the fourth. We call it the aqueduct of Sylvius, or sometimes the cerebral aqueduct. And CSF flows through this region. And then finally, it flows into the central canal of the spinal cord, all the way down to the conus medullaris, which is the tip of the spinal cord. It leaves the spinal cord and enters the subarachnoid space. So that subarachnoid space is between the arachnoid and the pia mater, and it flows back up the outside of the spinal cord all the way through the subarachnoid space in the brain, and there it enters the circulation. All right, let me see if there's anything else I want to say here. I think that's probably pretty good for this slide. All right, so the flow of cerebral spinal fluid okay, so it flows back up the outside of the spinal cord through the subarachnoid space into the brain. And, of course, it would build up in the brain, but there it is returned back to the circulatory system. So cerebral spinal fluid then leaves through this arachnoid villus right here. So here is an arachnoid villus, and there are some valves in here where CSF can leave and enter the blood, and this thing right here is called a sinus. So you don't have many veins in your brain, right? This is just a huge vein on the outside of the brain that's collecting blood that is nourishing your brain, and we call that a sinus, and that's where cerebral spinal fluid eventually empties into. All right, so we said where cerebral spinal fluid goes, right, goes back into the circulatory system via this arachnoid sinus. But what produces cerebral spinal fluid? All right, so cerebral spinal fluid is produced by the choroid plexus. All right, so here's a choroid plexus at the roof of the third ventricle. There's also some choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles, and even in the fourth ventricle right here. What did we call that nervous tissue, the type of that nervous system cell that lines the ventricles? It's got a particular kind of shape to it that actually looks more like an epithelium. We call that the ependymal cell. So here I see some ependymal cells right here. These line all the ventricles, and in a couple locations, these ependymal cells are associated with a capillary, so they're highly vascular. They can actually produce cerebrospinal fluid. So this right here would be an example of a choroid plexus, right? And they secrete oxygen, vitamins, as well as a number of electrolytes into the cerebrospinal fluid to help maintain the brain. Right, and this on this slide, you can also see that flow pattern. And for instance, if the aqueduct of Sylvius or the cerebral aqueduct ever gets blocked for whatever reason, right, then that cerebrospinal fluid, as it's being produced, is going to compress different parts of the brain, producing severe neurological deficits and actually deformation of the skull during development. We would call that hydrocephalus. And here's a condition that you see hydrocephalus, unfortunately, in this newborn. And then we would actually like to reduce that adhesion or maybe put in a drain, a tube, a shunt, to let that cerebrospinal fluid drain from the lateral ventricles or the third ventricle, hopefully preventing further damage to this infant's brain. And the interesting thing is, with proper prenatal care, right, this can be diagnosed very early in development before the baby's even born, and the shunts can even be placed in utero before the infant is born, right, just circumventing a lot of neurological damage before it even happens. All right, so that's another important reason to have good prenatal care. All right, so am I done? Actually, I'm still, yeah, you know what, I think I'm done, but I might cover some of these things when we start in 1 week. So don't forget about the test on Monday, okay? And SI later today, in 10 minutes, right?
No, 40 minutes.
40 minutes, SI is 40 minutes.